meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization that more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Amanda J. and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by a main speaker. Speakers, please note that you will be given a 5-minute and 1-minute reminder when it is time to wrap up your talk. Our first 10-minute speaker is Annie P.
Hi, everybody. My name is Annie, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Marty for asking me to share today. So just to give you a little bit of background, I am an alcoholic. I spent a lot of my years out there just trying to feel good. And when I say feel good, I mean I would just use it. I used drugs until I was oblivious, but in my mind, I was just trying to feel good, and I would drink and use, and because I was so focused on how I wanted to feel, I didn't really realize what was going on around me. Everybody was going up in life, I was going down in life. People were going on vacations, I was going to rehab. People were having kids, I'm going to jail. And I lived like that for many years. And I came from a family who drank and used and made a living around those means. So because my family background was like that, I always felt different because we weren't really like doctors or lawyers or anything like that. We were just living alcoholically. So I was going through a lot of rehabs, a lot of outpatients, a lot of inpatients. They sent me to AA, and all I knew how to do was to say, I have a court case, leave me alone. And, you know, finally, they just stopped sending me to treatment and started sending me to jail. And I was still saying, hey, I'm just trying to get high, leave me alone. Finally, my family decided, okay, you know what, let's give her a business. Let's give her a business, she'll be tied down to the business, you just stay there. And essentially, I had everything around this business and my workers and my family members babysitting me from morning, noon, and night, and I couldn't go anywhere without people watching me. And essentially, I was just tied down to this place. And I just thought, like, man, there's got to be an easier way to quit alcohol instead of having these people yelling at me every day. And one day I hit a spiritual bottom, a real bad one, where I just thought, man, if I could just please get sober, if I could just stop being a morning drinker, just all that. God, if it's AA, then let's do it. And I went to a meeting at Radford Hall. It was the noon, and I got struck sober that day. I remember before going in, I was like, let this be the message that's going to get me right. And it was. It was a guy who said my story in the way I needed to hear it. And I was just on fire with AA ever since. When I think about what AA has done for my family, how it has uplifted me out of my thinking, I just start crying because there was no way I could just have a different life without its help. And, you know, if you're new, just keep coming back. Keep coming back, just collect some days, collect some phone numbers. We're all not all that scary. and, you know, just give it a chance. But what it's like for me today is, you know, instead of my family hiding me, they're actually bringing me around. I'm in the loop for a lot of the events. People, you know, give me jobs. They look for me. They ask me to fix their businesses. You know, I'm a trusted member in my community. And all that is because AA taught me how to show up. I came to Pacific Group after 3 years. I was, you know, doing a lot of parking lot sobriety, then just, you know, character defects run wild. And finally, I got a sponsor where I couldn't hide some facts from, because she knew me before she started sponsoring me. And so when I did that fourth step, fifth step, she called me out. Lydia called me out to the point where I really needed that meditation afterwards. And, you know, we've just been doing a whole lot of step work for me to uncover, discover, and discard all that stuff that would bring me back to having the efforts again. So, like I said, if you're new, just give AA a chance. We're not scary people. You know, just pick up phone numbers and just stay around, because AA's been really wonderful to me. And I love you guys. Thank you.
Thank you. Our second 10-minute speaker is Michael G.
I'm muted. Okay. Hey everybody, my name is Michael. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 30th, 2019. I want to thank Marty for asking me to share. It is a privilege to speak at my home group. Now I kind of wish I didn't vote for you, Marty, but actually, wait, no, I didn't vote for you anyway. All jokes aside, I have alcoholism. In my opinion, that has nothing to do with alcohol. If it did, all I have to do is stop drinking and all my problems would go away. But that's not been my experience. My experience with alcoholism is when I stop drinking, when I stop using, my problems get worse. My head gets so loud that I go back to doing those behaviors that caused me to stop in the first place. Drinking, drugs, sex, money, food, all those things were my solution. They get me out of my head. They get me out of me. I don't like being in my own skin. I don't like being right here, right now. So that's my opinion of alcoholism. I was born in a small little ex-Soviet country called Moldova. Not many people know of it. And we came to America. My father brought us to America when I was just about 5 years old for a better life. And growing up in a poor immigrant household, you know, there was a lot of chaos, a lot of drinking, a lot of yelling, a lot of fighting, and not too much structure, not too much guidance. And early on, I learned how to lie, I learned how to steal, I learned how to manipulate. I learned how to get out of myself, and those would be the tools that I used growing up, that I used up until adulthood, until I got sober. So by age 10, I was already stealing alcohol from my dad, putting in little travel shampoo bottles that still had soap in them, and taking them to school and trying to find other kids like me, because I just wanted to fit in. I wanted it to be accepted by somebody. I felt out of place. And, you know, I always found those kids. And in fifth grade, my older sister started having me sell weed to my friends. And I began to get in a lot of trouble. And I kind of built this identity of this kid that, like, wasn't afraid to get in trouble and wasn't afraid of the consequences, and was always, like, the first one to want to do something like wrong, like, you know, pull the fire alarm or go to Petco and buy rats and let them out in the classroom in math class. Like, just anything that I could do to get, like, some type of negative attention. So that progressed. By 16, I was already breaking into homes and cars and, you know, stealing cars if someone left them running outside for, and I was what happened to walk by. And as a result, I was introduced to my first 12-step program, courtesy of the courts. And I had already saw that drugs, like, were creating problems in my life, but I built an identity around that, and I enjoyed it, and I was still having fun. So I did their little drug court program. I got my certificate, and I was on probation for a while, so I couldn't smoke weed and do other drugs. So I started drinking a lot. I would just ditch school with my friends. You know, I didn't go to high school. I went for the first day in ninth grade. I got my locker, and I never came back until they mailed a letter to my family telling me that I don't go to that school anymore. So we would just meet up, you know, by 17 years old, I'm drinking at 9 a.m. Like, we meet up at the school, we go steal alcohol from a grocery store, and we just go up to the park or a hiking spot in L.A., and we just get shit, we just get plastered and, you know, just laying out on the grass, like, living the life, I thought. So slowly things started to get a little worse. I started getting into harder drugs, and I started to realize that, like, hey, you know, maybe this isn't the best. Maybe this isn't going the way that I thought. It wasn't so fun anymore. I had less and less friends, not really people that I wanted. Like, I just saw my life going in the wrong direction. I had a lot of friends that were going to prison, a lot of friends that were dying, and like, I didn't want to have that type of life, but I wasn't ready to stop yet. I've seen the 12 steps already at that point, and I was like, I'm not powerless. Like, that first step is just not doing it for me. So yeah, my things got really bad, and at 20 years old, I decided I was desperate and willing enough to go to AA, and I started to do the things that we do around here. And my life got good really fast. I got a sponsor. I started doing the steps. And I got too busy. I got too busy for AA. I got too busy for meetings, too busy to call my sponsor. And 15 months stone cold sober, I just made a conscious decision to just eat half a bottle of pills of Vicodin that I had at my dad's house. And 3 days later, I became an IV heroin user. And like, when I hear people say that the disease of alcoholism is progressive, like, I can relate to that. I have experience with that. I understand today that abstinence doesn't equal recovery. And if I'm not working on my alcoholism on a daily basis, then I'm not recovering. So yeah, the next 9 years after that relapse were just miserable. It was rehabs and IOPs and detoxes and just watching my family lose hope in me and like losing hope in myself. Eventually I got to a point, I was going to the methadone bars for, you know, 5 years, and I woke up mid-January 2019 and I had just had enough. I was ready and willing and desperate enough to try something different and stop doing it my way. So I went like a good alcoholic. I went back to my mom's house to kick in her house. And I started my journey. It took me about 3 weeks before I could leave the house. And that's why my sobriety date is January 30th. And I started going to meetings. I had already heard about PG, and I was in and out for a long time. And this time I was physically sober and I was ready, and I jumped in. I started doing all the stuff that we do here. I went to a meeting every single day. I had 6 commitments. I started going early and leaving late. I started a fellowship. I was building relationships with alcoholic men that I called on a daily basis, and that people that I could be accountable to. And eventually I got my year, I got my watch, and I had been to so many watches for years, and I wanted one so bad. And it was an amazing night for me. It was everything that I thought it would be. And my family and my sponsor and my friends were all there. And it was really great. So I started to walk this path. I started to go to meetings. I started making amends, some that I thought I would never be able to make. And like, it's transformed my recovery. I had done multiple fourth and fifth steps in my in and out years, but I had never made it to a ninth step. And it was, it really like changed the relationships I had with these people that I had harmed, and I was afraid to like come clean about it. Yeah, I started going on the camping trips, you know, and Jeff really just gave me something to look forward to. And slowly I started to change, and I felt like I had a real chance at this life thing. You know, I finally moved out of my mom's house. I got a little apartment, and, you know, I had some issues with that. My roommate moved out, but I figured it out. Like, today I know that everything works out. As long as I don't panic and put take myself out of the equation, everything always works out. It's always has. That's why I'm still here. That's why I'm able to have this other chance. Yeah, so pretty much today I'm trying to work on my 10th and 11th steps more often. And you know, it's a daily struggle for me, and I'm still an alcoholic today. I have a really good life, but I still wake up sometimes, you know, riddled with self-centered fear, and I got to get on my knees and pray. I got to call to the people. And the solution for me is really simple. Less of me, more of you and of God. And if I can stay in that place, it's a good day. Yeah, pretty much. Thank you, Marty, for asking me to speak. You know, I really appreciate all your continued service to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's all I got for today.
Thank you. Our main speaker tonight is Paul W.
Okay, every time. Okay. Every time I unmute, it remutes everything. I don't know. I'm being judged. I'm at the Pacific Group, and I'm already being judged by a symbol. It's like, oh my God. I'm Paul. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for asking me to speak. That was very odd. I don't know if it was, you know, might have been the big amigo. Might have been, let's get any opening statement out of your head and circle back to the truth, you know. I'm Paul. I'm an alcoholic. I have a home group. It's Lucky 13. I have a in Huntington Beach. Actually, it's in Sunset Beach. I live in Huntington Beach. That's why I'm very excited, because I've never had this many people in my living room before. As I say, I've spoken a couple times at the Pacific Group, and it's interesting because from the very beginnings of my sobriety, which my sobriety date is March 15th, 1990, I actually had my last drink in September of 89, but in March 14th, 1990, I took a tiny little Valium that belonged to my girlfriend. And it was my girlfriend, so it was practically prescribed for me. Tiny little Valium. I had a big job the next day, and I used to have I'm sure I had a prescription for much more powerful Valium than this tiny little thing. So I ate it. I ate the Valium, and for about 3 years, I remembered that on March 14th, I ate that Valium, you know, and I was hitting meetings all the time. I was working with my sponsor at the time, Jerry H., and I always remembered March 14th. And then one day I realized, and I hated that I remembered March 14th. It was a pain in the butt. But one day I realized I had never shared that information with Jerry Hunter, my sponsor. And I, at that moment, I picked up the phone and I called him. He was a little tiny guy, about my size, maybe a little bit bigger. I'm 5'2". He was probably 5'3", or whatever, 5'4". He rode a full dress Harley. And he was so short that he could only stand on one side. Both feet wouldn't reach the ground at the same time. So every conversation with Jerry, he was going back and forth, like, I'll make you seasick if I keep doing that. But I called him on the phone. I said, Jerry, I have to change my date. He was like, oh, gee, oh, God. What? Well, all right. So we start again. I said, no, we don't have to start over. He said, well, what do you mean? He said, you need to change your date. I said, yes. He said, what happened? Damn. I said, I ate a Valium that belonged to my girlfriend. And he went, oh, damn, well, all right, when? I said, March 14th, 1990. And he was like, well, there's a great tense step, promptly admitted you were wrong. What the, where the hell have you been? And I said, you know, Jerry, it wasn't a slip until I realized that I had done something that was absolutely outside of the code of what is, you know, what is rigorously honest within this amazing program. And this program at that point, I already knew at that point that this program had saved my life. I was 49 years old when I got sober. I didn't have the best childhood, but I had the longest, and it ended with 10 years of just hiding out, you know, alcohol and other drugs and outside issues, as one of my sponsors and friends says all the time. It's an outside issue. I did a lot of those outside issues. And you know you're an alcoholic when you misplace a decade. I misplaced a decade. The 80s were gone, you know. But there was great information for me in that phone call to Jerry, and in how, first of all, how revered this was. And as much as I loved AA, as proud as I was to be a part of AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, as much as I sensed the, you know, the gift of my higher power and what he was giving me, I still managed to lie to myself for years, you know. And the information there is that there is core work that has to be done. And at this point in my life, at 30 years of sobriety, I'm realizing that it is really directly related to what is in the book. And most of us get to what is in the book through somebody that loves us and kind of tells us how they did it. I'll have to tell you that, okay, I have a home group, Lucky 13, in Sunset Beach. I also go to a big book study, you know, called Breathe in the Book on Thursday nights. At this point, it's on Zoom as well. At this point, you know, 30 years sober, I am stunned at what is in between the covers of that book, that it is to me an absolutely a living document. And suddenly things that I went through like that, not really stopping, will have meaning to me that makes me cry. And I cry all the time anyway. I'm, you know, I've hit that point in life, you know, where it's like, you know, try to stand up straight, don't hunch over, and for God's sakes, don't cry around strangers unless you have a really good reason, you know. But I mean, I look at something like, you know, neither opposes nor endorses. Neither opposes nor endorses. World's largest time saver for me, you know, because I have opinions on everything. And there was a lot of years when I felt like I needed to share them with everybody. I was raised in a construction family. My dad was a hard drinker, drank all day, and he was 6'2". I had two brothers who were 6-footers. It's a mild resentment there. But I was tiny. We moved every year. I went to 9 different schools by the time I was in the 9th grade. I'm 5'2". My dad was 6'2". I had 2 6-foot brothers. When I was about 9 years old, and this is an important part of my story, when I was about 9 years old, my dad observed that I was really tiny, and he said something to my mom like, should he be running under coffee tables now at this age? And she said, no, he shouldn't. We better take him to the doctor. So they took me to a doctor in Albuquerque, New Mexico, who was a, you know, I guess a little country doctor then. And he said, I know what to do. I'll get this kid growing for you. I'll give him some male hormone. Zap him with some masculinity, watch this little sucker pop up, and didn't work. What happens when you give somebody male hormone at that age? It begins to close off the bones. So instead of making me grow, it kind of kept me shorter than I was going to be. It did something else that was really interesting. At age 9, it kicked me into sobriety. Into sobriety, that's hilarious. It kicked me into puberty. At 9 years old, I hit puberty. And it got my full attention immediately. I had no interest all of a sudden in my the toy box, you know, the toy chest. But my Aunt Edna's chest all of a sudden required a lot of attention. And they observed this and they said, you know what, this is not good. So they took the hormones away. And all of a sudden my body was working on a clock that was really screwed up. So I didn't hit puberty till I was like 22. You know, now why is this important? You know, It's important for a couple of reasons. Anywhere I've ever been in AA meetings, anybody I've ever shared their story, again and again, the thing I probably hear the most is people saying, I always felt different. I always felt different. And I didn't feel different. I was different, but I didn't feel different. I think I started really, I really found about feeling different and connected with that much, much later in my life. But that those early years, which are key to, you know, to who you become, I got really good at ignoring the problem. I got really good at not even noticing that I was a lot shorter than everybody and all. And I covered it up with humor. I mean, humor became the whole thing. I was the master of the short joke. There's a couple of stories that I always tell, and I didn't start my timer. I was going to be so grown up and disciplined today. But, the fact is that I should probably I'll tell you one story about my dad. My dad got me up once when I was about maybe 11, and he said, "I'm going to take you to see a professional baseball game." And we were living in southern Ohio, right where Ohio and Kentucky and West Virginia come together. He was going to take me to see the Cleveland Indians play baseball. Drunk as a skunk, got us in the car, myself, my dad, and his best drinking friend in the front, a guy named Ike McShane. And so they're passing the bottle back and forth, and we're driving through a blinding rainstorm in the middle of the night to see the Cleveland Indians play baseball. And this is for all of the Al-Anons in the room. This was my dad talking to me about the ball game, back here talking to me about the ball game. And I'm going, "Dad, don't watch." I'm not saying it, but I'm thinking, "Don't watch me, watch the road." And I'll be 80 in September, but I can close my eyes and I can see that road in the rain and the headlights. And I felt like my concentration was keeping the car on the road. And it's just, it may very well have been the headwaters of my magical thinking, which served me for a lot of years. But we're driving through this, and incidentally, I'm not telling my dad's story, I'm telling mine, because I did the same thing with my children. I drove loaded out of my brains between LA and Santa Barbara, where I had homes. And I was a weekend dad. You know, but my dad was driving me through this horrible rainstorm to see the Cleveland Indians play baseball, and he drove to Cincinnati. He drove to the wrong city. You know, the Cleveland Indians don't play baseball in Cincinnati. So we arrive at the parking lot, and he was like, and "There's not a car there," and he was like, "Wow, we're going to get really good seats." And he waited a while, and eventually, he got up and he walked to the window, and the box office, looked at the schedule and realized what he'd done. And he came back to the car and he was wearing what we now call a wife beater, suit pants and slippers, not shoes, slippers. This was to go to a ball game. My dad drank. And he got in the car and he said something that I lived by for 49 years. He said, "There's not going to be a ball game today, my son, but it's the thought that counts." And I became one of the thoughtiest little creatures you would ever want to meet. There was a subliminal message in that for me that was like, I get it. You know, just I can be thoughty like crazy. And I thought about voting, but I didn't vote. I thought about being faithful. I thought about getting the job done, all the things that a responsible human being does. And I didn't do those things. It was about my feelings. It was about, you know, I found Alcoholics Anonymous, and all of that changed. You were my adult. At 49, you were my adult. And to the two speakers, incidentally, before, it's amazing that for both speakers, I could have picked up any point when they quit, at the point they each quit, and I could have carried on with the same enthusiasm for the program that I heard from both of them tonight. You know, and that's remarkable, because it just keeps changing. It's a gift that is spectacular. My dad was killed in a car wreck when I was 13. I was shipped off to live with an aunt and uncle and graduated from high school at Woodrow Wilson in Long Beach. I was 4'6" when I graduated. I'm 5'2" and shrinking right now. As you get to a certain age, you start going the other direction. That would be me. So I went to Long Beach. I went to high school. It was horrific. As I said, I hadn't hit puberty, and it's to go into the showers when you have a body that looks like it's made out of cantaloupe is really, really horrific. You know, my first prayer was, I don't care how big you make me, God, just cover me with fur. I need some hair like these guys have. You know, be careful what you pray for. I get stuff on my ears and growing out of the side of my nose that I don't need. If you saw me in high school, I was just busy. If you wanted to talk, I'd tap my watch and I'd walk off because I didn't know how to talk to people. When I got out of high school, I knew one thing. I wanted to be an actor. And to me, that was simply that I just didn't want to be me or know how to be me. I looked like a kid, so I got jobs and I did a few movies. It didn't really last. And eventually, that little shot of being an actor was absolutely gone. And to amuse myself, I began writing songs. And I spent my life writing basically codependent anthems, you know, just ouch mommy songs, pick me up and love me. And I began to drink. I think my first drinking experiences in high school were not about the booze. They were about the ritual, you know, to be a part of. This is what we do. We get drunk, we throw up, and we be somebody, you know. And the fact is that I found that there was a certain level of confidence that I got that just, I would dive into anything. And I had, if alcohol made me feel big enough to deal with the rest of the world, cocaine made me feel like I could shoot basketball for money. It was just everything I was looking for in that sense of, I can do this, I can do anything. That arrogance served me at a certain level. But it also stole something from me, which is the process of being in the moment with your higher power and stepping out of the way, getting my ego to step out of the way to let my higher power into the process of whatever I'm doing, listening to somebody, sharing my story, writing songs. It's spectacular. I drank excessively. I was the same kind of, you know, I was not a stay-at-home cute little guy that, you know, that was witty and I was out there, and I was out there with cars on the side of the road and people laying in the highway. I was responsible for some sad, nasty moments in life that were all on me. They were all on me. And I will also say that to cover my drug and alcohol use, I became a chronic and habitual liar. You know, that there is just the energy that I used just hiding my drugs and alcohol. And I have to mention drugs because of one specific element of my life. I will just, you know, let me leap ahead a little bit because this is not the longest pitch. But the fact is that I got married, I had a beautiful wife, I had kids, and the alcohol and drug use was so intense that at a certain point in my life, with a spectacularly a beautiful career that I don't think I was ever properly grateful for, I don't think I ever really had that pure gratitude moment, that career all of a sudden was behind me. I left my wife and my kids for a 22-year-old psych major who had said something to me that changed my life. She said, you know what? I love you too much to watch you die. So I'm leaving. And I went, it's amazing. I was just thinking of going to rehab. And I went to rehab for her and it didn't work. It didn't keep me sober. I went to a place called Schicksal, which was aversion therapy. I won't go into it, but they make you sick. And hopefully you relate that to drink instead of the joyous party that it had become. It was not a party. But I quit drinking. This young lady was somebody that I wanted to keep in my life. For 7 months, I had no alcohol. I mean, I had been a glass of vodka in the shower in the morning, drunk, turning work in late and everything like that, but I was not an alcoholic. Even when I got out of this little thing where they, you know, the aversion therapy, was not an alcoholic. But at 7 months of what my friend Wes calls sobriety, not sobriety, sobriety, at 7 months I went to Jamaica to work on a project. Now I'm a songwriter It's what I do. I've had a lot of success. I'm down, I go to Jamaica to work on the project, but all I want is to be special again, because my work made me feel special. You know, that's not where I get special these days. I get special because I'm in the center of the herd of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been blessed to find something that has put me back together, that is just a holy process. You know, but I'm down there, and all I want is one more hit. God, give me one more hit. So I said, there was a beautiful home, beautiful pool, where I was invited to come do this work. I sat up most of the night, and I wrote a song that I was convinced was going to bring me back. It was fantastic. I mean, I took my place beside you. I don't remember the words, but I remember the melody. I took my, I got a little sleep. I got up the next day around 1 o'clock or something. And I sat down around by the pool and with my little recorder and listened to what I had written. And I turned it on and I realized that I had rewritten "O Little Town of Bethlehem." And I went, geez, at that exact moment, a house man with white jacket and glasses and rum and Coke, all those things. "Mr. Williams, would you like a rum and Coke?" And I, absolutely. "I'm Paul Williams. I can have one rum and Coke. I can handle it. I'm a man with a lot of discipline. I can do it." And at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I had one rum and Coke. At 2 o'clock in the morning, I was at Bob Marley's grave explaining reggae to a lot of people I didn't know, and off and running. Just, you know, went home, didn't change, drank, began to have episodes. I had one massive episode. I went to Nashville. This was probably close to a year later. I went to Oklahoma City. Went to Oklahoma City to perform. And I hadn't slept in about 3 days and nights. So it was an afternoon gig. There's a knock at the door. It's the promoter. I'm walking out to do the gig with him, you know, and he's going to drive me to the theater. And the way he describes it is, I was thrown higher than my own head against the wall of the hotel we were in. And he said, you just terrified me. I was beaten up by an invisible monster. Nobody could see but me. Nobody could see but me. And for about 40 minutes, complete meltdown. The next day I did the show. I went back to LA and I continued to drink alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Continued to drink. And in a blackout about 10 days later, I called a doctor and I said that I wanted to get sober. And it was that moment, that where did it come from? You know, I was to find out later, but what happened is I went to into treatment and I found what we have today. And I found what I've been given. And again, part of me wants to just pull away from just the general story and talk to you about the fact that it is the essence of the whole deal. What began in rehab was a growing understanding that the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. That is the essence of everything I learned in rehab and what I'm trying to, at this point in my life, to connect with in a way that continues to change. Chapter 7, the first half of chapter 7 has enough to keep you busy for 2 years if you really look at it, if you really stay there and all. I started sponsoring guys. I did something that probably no other alcoholic ever did. I went to UCLA to get my certification as a drug and alcohol counselor. I entered what I refer to as the Pali Lama days of my life and loved it and absolutely loved it, and slowly but surely began to put my life back together. And what was my problem? My problem was power, that I did not have the power to deal with that, any of my problems and all. So the God of my understanding is an absolute joke, because I do not understand. I know that I have a higher power that is always there, and the connection is the most powerful thing in my life. I mean, I don't understand electricity. I use it all the time. You know, it brings light into my life. But the fact is, it's just, you know, I mean, this magnificence, this presence has put my life back together. I brought up drugs because I remembered something in treatment that was important to me, is that I remember calling the dealer and the dealer wasn't home and I'm going, damn it, where are you? Screaming, you know, cussing. The machine. And then finally you get, hello. And I would feel a jolt of optimism, fill my very being. The dealer was home and I was going to be all right. And I'd make a drink and I'd put a little ice in there in a clean glass, like a gentleman. And the dealer would come over and I'd begin to ingest my cocaine. And all of a sudden I felt awful. All of a sudden I'm wired. I nothing is working. And then I'm running. This is the worst crap I ever had. Where can we get some more? You know. But in that little moment when the dealer was home and I haven't used anything, what was I experiencing? I was experiencing total relief. Why? I think I was experiencing faith. I think that was a classic example of faith. And, you know, and the power of faith is, if faith in this poison is going to do that to me, what's going to happen? You know, if I put my faith in a true loving God, which is where I feel I am right now, I'm not the healthiest creature in the world. Incidentally, I sound like Broderick Crawford. You know, this is what happens when you work with frogs a lot. This happens to your voice. But I have to tell you that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group, incidentally, my sponsor, Mac, I think is in this beautiful seas sampler of spiritual giants, of recovering or recovered alcoholics. I choose to say recovering because it's a continuing path for me. I just love it. I go to my meetings and I sit down, and sometimes I'm not the healthiest guy that shows up at a meeting. Always the healthiest guy. I mean, I get a little cranky. I get in my head, get that walker out of my way. I'm going to an AA meeting. But I go to a meeting and I sit down, and it's very different, incidentally, from talking to a thousand or whatever Pacific group alcoholics, to sit in a circle of and as you know, that as one of the herd, and just sit there and just twitching. I mean, you know, and when I was new, I twitched. I was like, you know, when I got sober, I looked like a parrot. I was happy, joyous, and free. And Jerry was going like this, and I was going like that. We made a railroad crossing just being together, you know. But I sit down in a meeting, and I may be a little judgmental once in a while, listening to somebody share. And then eventually I slow down. Eventually I experience that stillness of, you know, yeah, my creator would have all of me. The short version of this whole deal. You don't even need to recycle the seven-step prayer. Take me all, the good and the bad. And that's what I feel at that moment as I sit in the circle. And then sometimes something that is just amazing happens. What'll happen is, let's call this guy Steve. Steve sits down. He says, I haven't been here for like 5 years. And, it's all good. I got a job. The job's great. The kids are great. And then he starts to slow down. And his body language changes. And his shoulders slump, and he said, you know what, I can't do it anymore. I can't. I mean, I had a drink after midnight. I don't think I even have today. And the energy in that circle just is so powerful, you could light up a room with it, which incident looks like I could use some of that fantastic light right now. It got dark while I was sitting here. But the fact is, at that moment, somebody who is in the worst moment of their life is turning to a circle of strangers, you know, and is being rigorously honest and has the courage to say, I'm dying and will you help me? That's how I think almost all of us got here. You're willing to do that. I was willing to do that. But to be then now on the other side of that, that's the continuing blessing. That's the ointment. That's the power of this deal, is that, you know, what expresses to me as the elegance of kindness is that in this broken moment, I could turn to a bunch of alcoholics and say, I don't know how to do this. Oh God, I don't know how to do this and I'm dying. Will you help me? And people came out of the woodwork. You know, Clancy, met Clancy early on. One of my two Clancys, I have to tell the very quickly the Clancy story. The two Clancys. I met maybe, I was maybe 6 years, or 6 years, about 6 months sober when I met Clancy. I was about 6 months sober when somebody started talking to me about this guy, Clancy. And I said, talk to me about what about this guy, Clancy? They said, well, you know, he's, you know, very, very hardcore disciplined and he won't let somebody clean up his yard unless they've got a year. And I went, you know what, that's outrageous. You know what, I've got a Clancy. I've got a guy I met named Clancy, and your Clancy ought to meet my Clancy, because my Clancy is a fantastic human being, works down at the mission, and he's just, you know, and somebody said, same guy. And at that point in my life, I went, I mean, I don't know what I thought then, but somewhere along the line, I began to realize, you know what, there are disciplines that you can follow. For example, you can follow a discipline and not worry about what you look like, but give people enough light to see you, because it's more important than you see me than I look good. What's more important is you realize that this spectacular gift is just, it just works if you're willing to dive into it. This is the best part of my story. And I'm sorry, I have to come back when I don't sound like this. It's just, I mean, everybody, it's interesting to have an entire screen full of people that all want to clear their throat because of the way you're sounding. But here's what happened to me that is the best part of my story. Is at about, you know, let's see, 10 years sober, I went to I went to Nashville to write a bunch of songs. And while I was there, I spoke at the jail. It's fantastic, you know, H and I, it's just, H and I walk out of a hospital or a jail, and you just feel like I am just too spectacular. You know, it's like this magical combination of Jiminy Cricket and Gandhi, you know, has been to the prison. Yeah. So I got you five minutes. Good timing, that actually, to get to this story. But anyway, I was in Nashville. I'd spoken at the prison. I went back to the hotel I was staying in, and I went into the hotel, and the hotel lobby was totally packed with all these guys wearing badges. And I went up to my room, and I was feeling like Jiminy Cricket and Gandhi, just that fabulous. And I went to my room, and the magnetic key would not work. You know, and it was one of those just, you know, it's a quick trip from Gandhi to Himmler for me. I was just like, son of me, because the key wouldn't work. I took it downstairs. I've learned restraint of pen and tongue in the room. So I walked up, you know, to the desk, and I said to the gentleman, look, I know it's not your fault, but why should I have to come down to this room three nights in a row? Why should I have to come in with all these guys here? You know, and there was a tap on my shoulder. And I turned around, there was a guy there, and his name was Gary. He said, you know, I don't want to bother you. I just want to say hi. I booked you 10 years ago, and it was really interesting. But I went, wait a minute, 10 years ago, I went, Oklahoma? And he had things in Oklahoma. And I said, yeah. I said, are you the guy when I went nuts for, you know, was thrown down escalator stairs where there was no escalator? And he said, yeah, that was me. I went, well, I'm 10 years sober, and I went to UCLA, and I just spoke at the jail, and I sponsor a lot of guys, and blah, blah, Pauly this, and blah, blah, Pauly that. And he said, yeah, I heard in the rooms that you were sober. And I was like, in the rooms, really? You're a friend of Bill. And he went, yeah, he reached in his pocket, and he pulled out a coin for 17 years. Yeah, and I did the math, and I went, oh my God, you were 7 years sober when I had that total psychotic breakdown, when my life was basically over. He said, yeah. I said, what did you think? He said, oh my God, it was so frightening. It was so scary. I thought you were dying. I said, yeah, it was bad, wasn't I? You know, said, yeah. I said, what'd you do? He said, I called my sponsor, because that's what we do. I call Mac. Like, Mac's 32, I'm 30, you know, and I'm 9 when I call Mac. I'll tell him the truth and tell him what's hurting, and I get good stuff back. We help each other a lot. He helps me more. But there was Gary Good, and with all this time and everything, I said, well, you called your sponsor. What did he tell you to do? He said, I'll tell you what we did on the spot. We got together a prayer circle for you, Paul, and a bunch of alcoholics in Oklahoma City prayed that you'd get sober, in or out of the rooms. However you were going to do it, we prayed you'd get sober. And it just, you will never be able to talk me out of the fact that there is a direct connection between those Oklahoma alcoholics praying for me. And when I was in a blackout, calling a doctor, there's an absolute connection there, you know, and it was at that moment that this whole deal became a gift, not something I'd worked for. And I believe that, well, I would always say it's all a gift. But the fact is, you know, I didn't believe it. The fact is that I speak when I'm asked to. I've sponsored a bunch of guys through the years. I try to be of service to, you know, to this deal whenever I can. But I didn't work for anything. This is all a gift. This is spectacular for each and every one of us that are participating in this. This is the deal. This is a lifesaver, and it's a path that will keep me alive. I hope for another 20 years. I hope I get another 20. I want 3 digits on my driver's license. I want a car that has nobody driving it to go by, and people say, "What the hell was that?" Oh, that was Paul Williams. Don't worry, he's sober. Don't worry, he's sober. My life is all about making sure that I have a certain connection to my higher power. I get up in the morning and I say, surprise me, God. We do it one day at a time. It's my birthday. Surprise me, God. I don't want to be a part of a piece of planning this day when I know what kind of day you can plan, because I've seen it for 30 years. I've seen the kind of things you can plan. So I say, lead me where you need me. Lead me where you need me. I've never felt more useful in my life. I apologize for the darkness. I apologize for the throat. But I'll tell you something. You will be hard-pressed to find anybody that loves alcoholics more than I do. And, you know, so Clancy, from those moments 29 and a half years ago to this day, I'm not willing to trade a day of it for the way it feels right now. You know, and I sound like, don't I sound like, I sound a little like Sinatra, don't I? Anyway, that's all I've got. God bless. Thank you, everybody. Stay safe. Stay safe.
Thank you.
Maybe wow.
But we'll see if we can accommodate something. We celebrate AA birthdays at this meeting. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything that would affect you from the neck up. If you're a regular attendee of this meeting, would like to take a cake, please email our scribe, Ann P., at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ann P. If you could please... make sure that you send me a picture of yourself, because now we're doing pictures. And also your name, first name, last name, sobriety date, and your sponsor. Thank you very much for letting me be of service.
Thank you, Anne. And please get this into us by 7:15. Otherwise, you have to wait until the following week. We're going to cut that time off a little bit sooner than that. We have several birthdays tonight. This week, I've got a special guest to sing us a happy birthday song all the way from Texas. Give it up for Hillary!
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear son. to you. Keep coming back.
And that's how we rock it. Tonight, our birthdays are, we have a 6-year birthday for Stephanie A, and her sponsor is Rose I. We have another birthday for Bonnie T for 8 years, and her sponsor is Terry B. We got Joe L, 10 years, sponsored by John G. Harvey K, 19 years, sponsored by Brad T. Frank N, for 21 years, sponsored by Clancy I. Charles K, for 26 years, former secretary, and he's sponsored by Tim K. Lloyd S, 28 years, sponsored by Tom B. Sean C, 32 years, sponsored by Tom B. Vivian P, for 33 years, her sponsor is Pat Y. Woo! Duffy N, for 40 years, former secretary, sponsored by Sharon C. Mary M, for 43 years, sponsored by Kevin B. Paul C, for 44 years, sponsored by Johnny H. And 46 years for Joe S, former secretary, sponsored by Clancy I. We have a total of 13 birthdays for 356 years, which the average is 27.38. Happy birthday to all of our celebrants. And thank you, Hillary, for that great song. All right. Let me catch up to my notes. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on your birthday cake. And at the end of the year, this candle money is our contribution to AA organizations worldwide. If you wish to participate in this custom, please email our treasurer, Betty H, at treasurer@pacificgroupla.org.